From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Food is an essential part of our lives. Not only does it keep us alive and healthy, but it provides a means of building connections with family and friend. What we eat can be a significant part of how we define ourselves. Some of this came up organically. Last year, we had a conversation about the Midwest and what makes someone a Midwesterner. Tommy in Urbana sent us a message saying, "A Midwesterner doesn't like pretension, weird food, crowds, when people stand or fish too closely, and fake anything. Likes are better homes and gardens type homemade food, cold weather, fishing, baseball, and humorous stories. The Midwest is from Ohio to Iowa and Illinois to the middle of Wisconsin. Missouri is not a Midwest state. I'm not comfortable living in any other area of the world, but we visit other places on Earth when possible." Thank you for that, Tommy. With that in mind, we're listening back to our conversation with Paul Fehrebach, the executive chef and co-owner of the Southern cuisine restaurant Big Jones in Chicago. More to the point for our conversation today, he's the author of a recent book about the history and the culture that have shaped some of our most celebrated foods here in the Middle West, and some that are maybe a little more ignominious. The book is Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. It's out now from the University of Chicago Press. We structured our conversation with Paul in three parts. First, his broader idea of Midwestern food and who's made it what it is now. Then some of the recipes and stories from the book. And toward the end, where Midwestern food fits into the bigger picture of American culture. Listeners, this conversation first aired in November of last year, and so we cannot take your calls, but let us know what you thought by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. Paul Fehrebach, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
All right, Paul, I want to start with an idea you try to put to rest early on in the book, and this is a myth, I guess, a lot of our country seems to have, that the idea that this Midwestern area is flyover country, it extends to our food. You say, "The reputation of the Midwest as a land of meat and potatoes has long engendered a bi-coastal attitude of derision. Outsiders roll their eyes as they decry our food as bereft of flavor, a cuisine sprung from cans and freezers. This image has never been accurate." Okay, you're here. But how did that image take shape anyway?
How it took shape is actually a good question, but my answer to that would be more or less that the coasts, and I allude to this in the book and other parts as well, that the coasts being the media centers of the country for, you know, our entire existence, you know, and certainly New York, with its influence in the media, sort of make any story about themselves. So when they're talking about American culture, American values, what is important in terms of our food is pertinent to our conversation today, they'll make the story about themselves. And so, you know, you have these New Yorkers trying to talk about hot dogs and where hot dogs came from. And so the story naturally becomes about themselves. And the Midwest has been an extremely important part of the country. Those of us here know that, for, you know, a century and a half. And they don't really want to acknowledge that because I think it takes power and influence from themselves.
So before we go too far into the conversation, I should mention last week we had a conversation about who and what the Midwest are. Turns out people in Idaho and Colorado, some of them actually think of themselves as Midwesterners. You know, what states do you include? What states don't you include? What does the Midwest mean to you?
I guess you could say Midwestern or the Midwest is a state of mind, certainly. So you could find people in Idaho and Colorado that would consider themselves Midwestern. They're certainly in the middle of the country, and depending on where you are in Colorado, particularly, you're between the two mountain chains, which might be an important geological barriers. But the definition of the Midwest that I sort of arrive at in the book, if we're trying to find a common cultural heritage, is a large prevalence of people of German American ancestry. And also, it's interesting because the Amish and Mennonites, these Anabaptist sects from southwestern Germany, the very northwestern corner of Switzerland, the very southeastern corner of the Alsace, also sort of came along with these German immigrants from the Rhineland, which populated the middle of the country here, also sort of wound up in these same areas as the people from the regular German population from the Rhineland. And so I was curious about this because I grew up around a lot of Amish people. The town where I was from, everyone was from these two little towns in Baden, which is a far southwestern state in Germany. And so I went to the census, U.S. Census's mapping engine, and used it and did, you know, every ethnicity, every religious background, every national origin. And it came out to be that what really defined the Midwest geographically was this large prevalence. So the Midwest is 25% plus German national origin, whereas nationally that's closer to 10%. Some states in the Midwest, some people wouldn't put, you know, for instance, the Dakotas or Kansas or Nebraska in the Midwest, but you'll find they have, you know, 40% and north of 40%, some of them, of people of German national origin. And that becomes a really important cultural identifying factor. And so we're looking at upstate New York and upstate Pennsylvania. So, you know, leave New York City, cross the river, leave Philadelphia, get into the western part of the state. There you're really talking about the Midwest as well, and all the way into the Dakotas, Missouri, and some of the plain states, all of the plain states really. And so that's kind of where we arrive at that definition, and it sort of fits with what you might say geographically, you know, between the mountains and north of the Ohio River.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you describe the idea of Midwestern food, obviously more complex than the meat and potato stereotype, but you talk about it as a patchwork quilt. Say more about that metaphor.
Well, there are a lot of different ethnicities in the Midwest, people of different national origins. In the cities, we have large African-American populations, large Latino populations, populations from every country in the world at this point. And so, you know, these over time have sort of integrated with one another and not necessarily existed as islands, as they tend to do maybe in the first generation of an immigrant culture. You see this a lot now with more recent immigrant communities, such as Burmese, Somali. Even to some extent, you know, the Thai immigration is mostly on its second generation. Immigrants come, they open restaurants, they cook in their homes, they open grocery stores. And for the first generation, really, those cuisines sort of exist as an island. But the second generation, once they have kids and their kids go to school and start mixing with people from other backgrounds, you start getting things like, you know, Korean fried chicken on tacos. Or people making barbecue and putting them on bao. So it's sort of these generational ties sort of patch this quilt together from all of these different disparate parts.
Yeah, and the other metaphors, you think of the metaphors we use for this, be it a melting pot, right? I don't know if that sounds very appetizing. There's that old Schoolhouse Rock song about that. I don't know, maybe the cuisine, the food metaphor is more of a salad, right? Where you have these different ingredients coming together, but still maintaining their own texture, their own flavor.
Yeah, I like that. I like that metaphor a lot.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk. You hit on some of these ideas of African-American populations, Hispanic populations, especially in our urban centers. But let's talk about the role of non-white Americans in creating the cuisine we have today. Talk more about how Black Americans in particular, we'll start there, fit into that food picture.
Well, Black people, Black Americans are probably one of three ethnic groups that have a really outsized influence on the way America eats. based on their population nationally, I think we're talking about maybe 10% of the population in the Midwest, a little bit less than that even. But barbecue culture, and everybody loves barbecue, has really been, from the days even before the Midwest existed in the South, it's been a tradition and a culture that's passed down through Black hands over generations. Certainly in the Midwest, we have barbecue traditions. In Kansas City is quite famous for theirs. St. Louis is lesser known, but I think just as good. And Chicago has a generations long barbecue culture on the South side and on the West side. And it's interesting that you can start in someplace like Kansas City or the Delta region and Memphis, which is where a lot of African-Americans came during the Great Migration to Chicago, to St. Louis. If you start there and think about the barbecue culture, and then you get to Chicago and it changes. But here in Chicago, it's actually kind of isolated because of segregation. And so it's one of the things that I talk about in the book as well, and contemplate about the factor that segregation, or the role that segregation plays in sort of maybe keeping some of the parts of this quilt discrete and separate, because people from the North side and people from the West side won't go to the South side. So a lot of the people don't even know that there's this really delicious generations long barbecue tradition. And it's a shame because it's really delicious. And, you know, we all see the hyperventilating on the news about the crime in Chicago. And it's really, you know, statistically, we're not, if you look at it, you know, per capita, we're not in the top 20 or even in the top 50 in most crime statistics. The South side is, I go there all the time. There's just nothing, there's just really nothing to worry about. It's like being in any other city in the Midwest.
Yeah.
So there is segregation. Latino communities come and work in restaurants, and I think more directly impact food. But again, if you go back generations before there were large numbers of Mexican and Central American immigrants, there were Southern Blacks coming to the North, and they're cooking. So they're in their labor. Those were the jobs that they were taking. And so they're very directly influencing the foods we eat in Saratoga, New York, which I would put in the Midwest. You know, there's a Black man, the name is escaping me at the moment, invented potato chips. Hmm. And they were called Saratoga chips for a couple of generations, and eventually just called potato chips. But you know, and here I am talking about Midwestern food being more than meat and potatoes, and talking about potato chips. But it's another example of how influential Black Americans are to the way we eat, in spite of, you know, maybe being 10% of the population.
Yeah. No, and I was thinking when you were talking about Hispanic or Latino food, it's amazing how small a town you can get in Illinois, and they still will have a Mexican restaurant with. You know, reasonably good food, maybe not the most, you know, authentic, whatever that means. And we can talk more about that. We do need to take a break in a couple of minutes, but I do want to, before we get to that, I don't want to leave out the indigenous cultures that once called so much of the land that is now the Midwest home. How has Midwestern food co-opted some of their culture as European settlers were pushing them out?
Well, I think, and this might be part of the German factor. And I don't know if I say this in the book specifically, but I say this in private conversation all the time, that a lot of Germans don't really like to mix. And so German immigrants might come to the cities, and then they'll move to the country. Certainly where I grew up is a town where everybody's from these towns in southwestern Germany, and everybody who lives there has been there for five generations. And, you know, my last name, Fairbach, you only find there. I think there might be two or three of us now outside of DuBois County, Indiana. And so they really weren't, maybe they were less interactive with First Nations cultures, I think, than settlers might have been in some other regions. Certainly in the Southwest, there's a much more prevalent indigenous culture in the food. But the policy of Indian removal was well underway, or the they called it Indian removal, but the policy of removal of First Nations from their ancestral lands was well underway by the time the Midwest was being settled. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that we just don't really know. And because most of the work that was done in cataloging these cultures wasn't really focused on foodways. When people were sort of researching them, and now anthropology, they might go and find, you know, yeah, they were eating goose foot. Yeah, they were eating cranberries. And yeah. If you go north of a certain line, I want to say it's the Menominee River, corn becomes a lot less prevalent. We know these things, but we don't know a lot about what they were cooking. And it's really a shame because, you know, they left us. They left a beautiful and well cultivated land, or like, well taken yeah. care of land.
We'll have to pick this up after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For the entire hour, we're listening back to our conversation on Midwestern food and what made it what it is now, what's behind some of your favorite Midwestern foods, and maybe why it doesn't get as much credit as it deserves. We talked about all this with Paul Fehrerbach, executive chef and co-owner of the Southern cuisine restaurant Big Jones in Chicago. He's also the author of the book Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. I do have one bit of a fact-check enhancement on something that came up in the last segment. This is from our news director, Reginald Hardwick, communicating with us behind the scenes. It was George Speck, son of an African-American father and a Native American mother, who's credited with inventing the potato chip at Moon's Lake House in 1853. That's how the story goes. Anyway, that origin is hotly debated even now. Because this conversation's on tape, we're not taking calls today, but you can let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121.
All right, Paul, so you talk a little bit in the intro to the book about one of the guidelines you kept in mind as you were deciding what to include, and I want to ask you about that. The idea of what makes a food truly Midwestern as opposed to, say, I don't know, an old family recipe that just happened to be passed down through generations in the Midwest.
Yeah, I think that it might be considered arbitrary, but it also sort of indicates some staying power, that it's been established in the Midwest. Every immigrant community brings their own foods, and some of them stick around and some of them don't. But if an immigrant community is eating, you know, say, a Thai immigrant comes and they're eating, say, Pot Prik Khing, this dish of pork and green curry with basil and chilies. That's Thai cuisine. If it's still around in, you know, 90 years and everybody's eating it, that might be considered Midwestern food at that point. Certainly hot dogs would be considered Midwestern food at this point, but at one time they were something that came with immigrants from the high country in southern Germany and Austria. And so over time, these things can become Midwestern if they become creolized or become part of the larger culture, basically leave their immigrant community. So that would be considered the three generation threshold, which is to say the immigrant community was here and then their children who had still that first generation, that direct connect to the old country would be eating it. But if their children are still eating it, now completely detached or with no real attachment to the old country, if they're still eating it, then it's Midwestern. So it's established itself here beyond the immigrant, beyond the wave of immigration. And then the other thing that I consider is if something evolved here uniquely, that we could say it's obviously Midwestern pizza is, it, you know, it comes from Italy. Every region of Italy has some form of flatbread. But if you look at Detroit style pizza or Chicago style pizza, whether it's thin crust or deep dish, these types of pizza were actually invented here. So even though pizza hasn't been around that long, I know people might have a hard time imagining that pizza culture in the Midwest is about 70 years old. It hasn't been around forever. It's still distinctly Midwestern. St. Louis style pizza is distinctly Midwestern. It was invented here. So if something is invented here or develops here through creolization of other cultures into the mainstream, then that would also be considered Midwestern.
Ah, that's so interesting that it's only been around, you say, for 70 years. My grandparents, you know, were born in the teens, and they were not big pizza people. So I guess maybe that's not something they grew up with. It came to them later in life. You know, you do get into, obviously, the book is filled with recipes. That's a big part of it. And I want to get into a few of those. We had some of our listeners send us messages asking about some of these. Abby in Urbana told us, when I hear Midwest, all I can think of are casseroles and crockpot meals. Now, you do talk in the book about how that idea took shape. So how did the Midwest come to be associated with those sorts of meals?
Well, that's actually a preconception about Midwestern cuisine that is largely true, but it's because the Midwest, through from the very beginning, whether you are farming in the country, that's very, very, very hard work, less hard than it used to be, but it's still hard work. Or you were immigrating to the city and working in factories, sort of the two dual income household was invented here with industry. You have two parents working. You are, in the case of being city folk or suburban folk, you are separated from the country. You're probably not growing your own food, or if you are, it's supplemental. And you're very busy. And at the same time, you have the meat processing industry in Chicago and St. Louis and Kansas City making ground beef really cheap, making sausages really cheap, different cuts of meat very cheap. The poultry industry in the early 20th century explodes. And so you have all of this food that is now increasingly industrialized. And you have really busy people, and you have kids in school, and this concept of a casserole actually came from the USDA in trying to show people how they could make a quick and easy meal to get all four food groups, which is how we used to talk about nutrition, to get all four food groups into something simple that kids could take to school. And that eventually grew into something you could have for dinner, because you can go and get frozen vegetables, and you can get a starch, and you can get a protein, and you can get a can of soup, and you can throw them in a casserole. It takes a few minutes, put them in the oven, forget about it for an hour while you're taking care of your chores, while you're doing your homework, while you're taking care of extracurricular activities, and then you come back and dinner's ready. It's really a masterpiece of efficient nutrition. And so that became, you know, casseroles really became a thing because we were busy putting people in cars, putting people in homes, really being growing food for people, producing food for people. We were the industrial beating heartbeat of the United States, and we were very busy doing it. And so, we have casseroles. It's true. And they're delicious.
Rolf is calling on line four from Crescent City. Rolf, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. I've called in before, but I think I have kind of a unique perspective because I grew up in Chicago. I married a woman down in Iroquois County, and we have a country house down here now. And we spend a lot of time down in central Iroquois County. And just yesterday, I was down in Gordyville in Rantoul. So we travel a lot, go down to Champaign, Urbana, and go to restaurants there, as well as in the Chicago area. And one of the things I would say is that the countryside, you know, like Iroquois County farm country, has been depleted of population, primarily because farmland has, you know, expanded so much and farmers need so much more land. So that's caused a decrease in the population, and there's less businesses, there's less restaurants, and a lot of the restaurants are kind of just migrating towards grills in the country. In other words, you have a lot of great restaurants in Chicago and places like Champaign, but in between those areas, other than like in Kankakee or some of the larger urban areas, you really have places that if you want to go find something where you can get a good salad or some healthy food, it's very difficult to do that, very hard to find. So also, I would like to comment a little bit on the German aspect. Iroquois mm-hmm. County and Champaign has a lot of Ostfriesen Germans, which are people that are from the northwest part of Germany, and they're kind of Frisian is in their ancestry. But after five generations, those people came here in the 1860s and early 1870s, and those people have so completely integrated with the other, English and other Germans and whatnot, and other nationalities, that a lot of them don't even know what their ancestry is. You only can tell that by their names. But and with regards to like casserole dishes, those are the types of things that you see in churches, but you don't see that like in restaurants, So
yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
Some of my comments.
No, I appreciate that, Rolf. Thanks. A lot to chew on there, if I may. And Paul, I guess, I don't know, take that where you will. Maybe you want to start on the restaurant scene outside of the bigger or even mid-sized metropolitan areas in downstate and what depopulation and modern agriculture has done to being able to get different types of foods out.
Sure. Thanks for the call, Rolf. A lot of very salient observations as far as the restaurant industry goes. Well, depopulation in the rural part of the Midwest as well. You mentioned that farms needed bigger and bigger, more and more land to be able to produce this food. But we also have to remember that it takes fewer and fewer people to actually do the work now. And it's also, so you don't really need, my grandpa had grew tomatoes and sold into the Red Gold co-op. And I think he had about a 40 acre farm, and he had 11 kids and they all worked on the farm. They didn't have migrant labor at the time to do that. And certainly when you were doing grains, it took a lot more. The machines didn't harvest nearly as much as fast as they do nowadays, and it would take a lot more labor to even to grow things like corn and soybeans, which became increasingly important during the 20th century. And so you have depopulation in the rural parts of the state, and it's one of the things that I have noticed, because I am from the rural Midwest as well, is that it's kind of sad how a lot of these rural communities have kind of given up on traditional foodways. The restaurants, to a large extent, they're gravitating towards simple bar and grill type things, where they can, buy pre-cut meat, buy, pre-processed vegetables and all of these things from a Sysco or a US Food Service and put them on a plate. And the more people buy those types of things, which I would call, even if it's a locally owned independent, it's just like chain food, it's industrial food. The more people patronize those places, you're going to find fewer and fewer independent places that actually do cook. And it's surprising if you really look, and there are some really good blogs you can look at. My favorite, and I profile him in the book, is Titus Ruschitti, who's based in Chicago. And has a blog called chaibarbecueking.blogspot.com. And he has traveled for work, and he makes a point of going into any town and finding the one place that is still doing the same thing it's been doing for 60 years and is still cooking and has some real local identity and flavor. And it's really surprising. Because if you look at the restaurant landscape across most of the Midwest, especially the suburbs and the country, it can be a bit depressing. But if you look really closely, most towns still have a really cool old diner or cafe that's been there forever. And in Indiana, at these places, you find breaded pork tenderloin sandwiches, you find sugar cream pie or coconut cream pie. The old I-55 corridor in Illinois has a lot of places that make phenomenal burgers and have been doing it for, you know, 60, 80 years. The Smash Burger, which is a really trendy thing in the city now, is from the rural Midwest. And in Illinois, the I-55 corridor was the Route 66 corridor was a real hotbed for that. Mm-hmm. So definitely something to look at. Titus has any town you're in the Midwest and almost the entire country, he has a restaurant or two or three that you can go to that have a lot more going on. And that's always an encouraging thing to see. And if we patronize these places, then they're going to continue to exist. If we give up and just go to Panera or that new bar and grill that's serving, you know, pre-cut steaks and pre-processed vegetables and soup that they bought in a bag, you know, then there's going to be more of those. It's, you know, what do you want to do with your food dollars? So I encourage people to follow these bloggers. A site called Road Food, Jane and Michael Stern is another good one. Anywhere you are in the country, they list a few dozen restaurants in Illinois that are doing really cool things and have that local flavor. If you patronize these places, they're going to continue to exist. So, you know, vote accordingly with your dollars.
Yeah, now I've got the image of soup in a bag in my head for the rest of my day. That was very evocative.
I couldn't give you the statistics, but it's probably 90%+ of the soup that's served in restaurants nowadays. Wow. And I always just wonder, why would you go out and pay a restaurant markup for that, and then you know, the tax and tip for food that you could have bought at the grocery store and reheated yourself. But that's a lot of what restaurants serve. And that's not just true in the Midwest. It's true in the whole country now.
Yeah. Let's get another caller in. Only a couple minutes till we have a break. But Terry is calling from Melbourne, Florida. National reach with the 21st show today on line one. Terry, thanks for calling in again.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment on two things with regard to the history of pizza in Illinois. The first time I can remember ever encountering pizza was in Bloomington at the place called Casella's that's no longer there, and that was in 1957. So that's in the context of the 70-year time frame you've given it. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I wanted to comment on was the Waldorf salad, because having grown up in rural central Illinois, that salad was ubiquitous at any public gathering or potluck or anything like that you ever went to.
Amazing. All right. Thank you so much for the call, Terry. Just about a minute to comment on that if you want, Paul. But the Waldorf salad, whatever happened.
Oh, Waldorf salad is a great one. And, you know, that's one of the recipes that didn't make it in the book. I think I was at about 120,000 words and the publisher said, no, stop, you're done. And so there's going to be a follow-up of some sort, but I love hearing from people about recipes or dishes that they have that they think should be in the book and that aren't, because we missed a lot of stuff, not intentionally, and a lot of stuff. I have a long list of dishes that I knew we were missing before we even published. And Waldorf salad, honestly, I didn't think about, but I had a lot of that growing up as well. That's a really good one.
We have to take another pause on the program. More from our conversation with Chef Paul Fehrebach. His new book is Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our program all about Midwestern foods and recipes. What made it what it is now? What's behind some of your favorite Midwestern foods? And why maybe our cuisine doesn't get as much food credit as some people believe it deserves? And the effect that's had on the rest of the American food culture. Our guest for this was Paul Fehrebach, executive chef and co-owner of the restaurant Big Jones in Chicago, which specializes in Southern cuisine. He's also author of the book, Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. Because this conversation's on tape, we're not taking calls, but let us know what you thought by sending an email to talk@21stshow.org. You know, Paul, sometimes I like to borrow a game from the economist Tyler Cohen. It's called Underrated or Overrated. Quite simply, I'll name a food or recipe or concept from the book. You tell me if it's something you think is underrated or overrated, if you are game.
Sure.
All right. The horseshoe.
Overrated.
Overrated. Okay. For listeners who don't know, this is the classic Springfield concoction of a Texas toast, burger patty or ground beef and fries and cheese sauce. Why do you say overrated?
It's just rich and plodding and heavy. And I talk about that in the book. I provide a recipe and maybe some ideas for making it a little less heavy and plodding. But yeah, it's a heavy dish.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Fun fact about myself, I've lived in Springfield for 19 years, never once ordered a horseshoe. Italian beef, underrated or overrated?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I would say probably underrated.
It's tough depending on the restaurant you go to, I guess.
Exactly. A really good, if you've had, I think a lot of people have experienced mediocre Italian beef. And in that case, yeah, it's definitely overrated. But if you've had it at, you know, an Al's Number One or a Johnny's, it's just one of the best sandwiches you could have. So I got to say underrated.
Okay. On that note, the TV show, The Bear.
Actually, I haven't watched it.
Oh,
I work
okay.
in the restaurant business.
This is about a Chicago. Yeah. We had a segment on it a couple months ago when season two was out. This is about a Chicago beef restaurant that tries to elevate itself into the next tier of cuisine. All right. Fair enough. What about corn boils? Underrated or overrated?
Corn boils?
Yeah.
I would say, I'd say overrated.
Wow. All right. Well, I see a trend here. Okay. Next one. Arguments over deep dish pizza. And again, not pizza casserole itself, which gives you an indication of my views, but arguments over deep dish pizza.
Underrated.
Underrated. Say more.
I think we could argue about it all day long. And there's definitely valid arguments on both sides of it. You know, bring it on. My view of it actually probably changes day to day. So you could argue with me, I'd be on one side one day and on another side and on the other side the next day.
I hear you on that. Underrated or overrated? Shaming people for putting ketchup on hot dogs.
Oh, that's underrated for sure.
So you are a no ketchup person, NK17.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you like ketchup, go ahead, but I think I talk in the beginning of the book about the chapter on condiments, about how ketchup has just kind of taken over everything. And I love ketchup, but, you know, try something else.
Yeah. All right. Last one, I think. And I'm going to quote from page 148 here. Amalgamations of gelatin and random ingredients. Underrated or overrated?
Underrated.
Say more.
I think we need to bring back the Jell-O salad. Maybe not necessarily always using Jell-O brand gelatin, but I guess I always would have said overrated. I always thought that they were kind of scary, even when I was a kid.
Yes.
Because people would just do the most frightful things with gelatin. And I had some aunts who were like really into it. So there would always be just these horrific concoctions at the family reunion.
I'm reminded of the Aunt Bethany character in the movie Christmas Vacation, whose Jell-O mold has cat food, regrettably, included into it.
Yeah, that's a really good one. But I mean, if you have a good one, and there are good ones that exist, the pretzel salad recipe in the book is just an utter delight, and everybody should make it at least once. So, you know, I think we have to be very wary of the Jell-O salad, but we should also embrace the ones that are good.
Yeah, fair enough. And no offense if my mom is listening. She does make a good Jell-O salad. Let's go back to the phones. Asa is calling from Niantic on line 4. Asa, thanks for calling in.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm well.
I was just going to say, you know, sorry, my doorbell's going off. I live in Niantic, which is central Illinois. I grew up in Belleville, real German name, Kaiser. And let me tell you, I raised my kids on casseroles, shepherd's pie, and Jell-O fruit salad. That's how we started with fruit with our kids. But, you know, we were always busy, and that was a way. You know, I was a foster mom, had my kids going to grad school, working as a teacher, and being able to throw things in a crock pot or make a casserole. was how we survived. The grandparents came over for dinner. I had a grandpa who grew the biggest green beans, and he was proud of it. And the only way to soften those puppies up was in a casserole. So we, you know, we grew up on that kind of food, and I felt like we had a good diet. We were healthy. We never ate junk food, and I still serve it to kids today. And in our community, we do casseroles a lot and then take them, split them up, you know, take them to the seniors in our community who are on their own, because that's easy and quick for them. And, you know, it's something nourishing that they're familiar with and they'll like.
I hear you 100% on that. In fact, my favorite part of Thanksgiving is not actually the turkey itself, but my mother-in-law's turkey tetrazzini she usually makes the next day, which I think that qualifies as a casserole, I think. All right.
So too.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call, Asa. Paul, do you want to respond to anything you heard there?
Yeah, thanks, Asa. That's really good stuff, and you're absolutely right. There's a lot of nutrition in that and the efficiency, and I forgot to mention earlier, one of the best things about casseroles is that they travel. So family reunions, social gatherings, Midwesterners are the nicest people. I know we all say that, but we would seldom go anywhere without bringing a covered dish, a six pack of beer, some contribution to whatever the event is. So that's another one of the blessings of a casserole.
I think in my family somewhere, someone has one of those Pyrex or Corningware. It's like a tote bag for casserole dishes to keep it warm on the way to the church picnic or wherever you might be going with it. So let's come back to, actually, we have another caller on the line. Sandy is calling from Peoria on line two. Sandy, thanks for calling in.
Yeah. Hello?
Hello, you're on. Thanks for calling in. I understand you had an excellent diner lunch recently.
Yes, it was a small diner in Dunlap, Illinois, which is almost part of Peoria. And it's I went there for my birthday. Two of my daughters took me for my birthday, and we had the name of it's the Mayflower Diner. So we had a little lunch, like sandwich. You could eat breakfast, so I had breakfast. And then as we were getting ready to leave, they heard that it was my birthday. So I got a free piece of coconut cream pie. And so being 86, I will still say this is the best coconut cream pie I ever had.
Well, that is quite an endorsement.
And then they played a man from the back, sitting a few tables away, played Happy Birthday on his harmonica. So I want to say, it was a pretty good birthday.
It sounds like it. Sandy, happy birthday. Thanks so much for calling in. Paul, just about 5 minutes left in our time together, and I do want to go sort of bigger picture in what we have left, and that is, you know, the idea that I think takes shape as Midwest food goes on, the book goes on, is that, you know, the Midwest is not only not flyover country, but you might even go so far as to call it the food capital of America, right? So many things we take for granted as part of American the American food landscape now took shape here in the Midwest. Say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that comes from the large German population here, and there is the Germans are actually the largest group in the United States by national origin. It's just a much larger proportion here in the Midwest. Things like hamburgers and hot dogs, and we trace the origins of these and the high probability and likelihood that not only did they come from here, but also that it was our meatpacking industry that made ground beef cheap so that hamburgers could be in every table. But in the mid 19th century, a hamburger, or at that time called a Hamburg steak, was an extremely expensive delicacy because you had to be able to pay a butcher to chop the meat up by hand. And hot dogs the same way. They actually used to make hot dogs with filet mignon, with beef loin and bacon. And they were called Wienerwurst or Frankfurters. And they were expensive luxuries for the wealthy. And so it was our meatpacking industry that changed that. It was certainly our breadbasket that really changed the way people eat, not just in America, but largely throughout the world as well. And Minneapolis with the confluence of the rivers there, has been sending flour throughout the country again since the late 19th century, and taking all of that wheat and turning it into flour. And they invented Washburn Ashby, which is now General Mills, invented Betty Crocker in order to get people to show people how to use their products, primarily gold medal flour, but also a growing portfolio of products as General Mills expanded. So, you know, Betty Crocker's largest listener base on her radio show in the 1930s and 40s was actually in the South. So, you know, they were interested in being really good at baking cakes, and Betty Crocker was the one who took them by the hand and showed them how. You know, we could go on. I think that our pizza culture is the best. I love New York style pizza. I love New Haven style pizza. But nowhere else in the country, and nowhere else in the world, honestly, other than Italy, can you stand in any one spot and travel, you know, a few hours in any direction and find a different regional pizza style. And that's one of the coolest things about the Midwest. So I could go on, but those are just a few of the reasons we're the most influential and important food region in the country.
Yeah. Well, last question then, in just a couple minutes, but, you know, we talk about Southern food, we talk about California cuisine. Do you think someday Midwestern food will have that same national recognition that those other cuisines do?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly hope so. I wrote this book to tell the story of the Midwest in through food. And I think recipes are the best way to do that, is why it's a cookbook. I hope people will cook the recipes because they're delicious. But at the end of the day, I don't really care. I love Midwestern food. I think that what I would really like people to take away from the book, Midwesterners certainly, is to take another look at our food and be proud of it, because it really is something. And, you know, when the coasts deride us for, you know, meat and potatoes or casseroles, we can, you know, fly the bird right back at them, because we know what we have, we're proud of it. And, you know, I think if we really embrace it, instead of maybe, you know, kind of having our heads down about it a little bit, you never know. It might become the hot new cuisine. But whether it does, I don't really care.
Fair enough. If anything, please don't order your soup by the bag. Paul Farabach is the author of Midwestern Food, A Chef's Guide to the Surprising History of a Great American Cuisine, with more than 100 tasty recipes. It's out now from the University of Chicago Press. He's also the executive chef and co-owner of the Chicago restaurant Big Jones. Paul, this was great. Thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st
Show.
Thanks,
Brian. It was a good time.
And that is all the time we have for the show today. Coming up tomorrow, before the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Roe against Wade recognized a constitutional right to an abortion, women still found ways to end their pregnancies. In Illinois, from 1969 until 1973, that could have meant seeking help from an underground feminist abortion service codenamed Jane. We'll revisit our conversation with historians and members of that group. Before we go, will you consider joining our texting group? You put the public in public radio, and we love sharing your comments and questions on the show. Join by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, text the word TALK to 217-803-0730. We love hearing from you about our programs and your suggestions for future guests or stories. You can email us. Talk at 21stshow.org is the address. And that and every other way to contact us, including voicemail, social media, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there, and you can find links to subscribe to our podcast, or just look us up on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Stephanie Mosqueda. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.